You've just tuned into Outdoor News Radio, a weekly showcase of the top outdoors writers and experts in Minnesota and across the region. I'm Outdoor News Managing Editor Rob Dreeslein, and I'm honored to have you join us for the next hour as we break down hunting, fishing, and natural resources topics affecting your ability to recreate in the Western Great Lakes and beyond. Our guests might challenge you occasionally, but we promise to entertain you while we're at it. Don't go away, because if you love this state's fine outdoor scene, you'll love Outdoor News Radio. This segment is sponsored by Ducks Unlimited. Join the thousands of volunteers having fun more than 3,500 times a year. Get involved at www.volunteerfordu.org.
Hey folks, welcome to another week of Outdoor News Radio. You got Rob Dreeslein here for the next hour. We're going to talk a little bird watching with our friend Sharon Steitler, the bird chick. The Christmas bird count is underway. Maybe we'll mention that a little bit. Then Tony Roach will join us. You may have noticed there's a lot of ice, some great ice fishing opportunities across Minnesota and the region. We'll talk to Tony, get his take on that a little bit. Les Meister will help us wrap up as usual, but let's kick things off with the one and only Tim Spielman, editor at Outdoor News, and talk about some headlines in this week's paper. Tim, welcome. Yeah, quite a weather roller coaster, huh? Man, deep freeze, and then on Tuesday, man, it was like warm. It felt like 45 degrees out there, at least in the metro.
Well, it's probably closer to normal than the 15 to 20 below that we experienced last weekend. I'm glad that's gone. But yeah, it should have made ice. I know there was some snow that we talked about last week too that probably got in the way. Around my area, there's some slush beneath that snow. So it did mess things up a little bit. But I'm sure in most places, there's ice making going on. I talked to someone a couple days ago out in the Osakis area, and it seemed like lakes were freezing up well. Overall, yeah, and the warm-up wasn't enough that's going to affect ice,
no.
Especially the way the sun is this time of year and yeah. The fact that you'll get, what, 2, 3, 4 hours above freezing generally.
Right. So, right, yeah, the days are so short right now. In fact, this is solstice weekend, isn't it? So
yes, it is.
If I forget at the end of the segment, Tim, Merry Christmas to you and yours here this coming week.
Yeah, you as well.
And all of our listeners. We've been every week kind of updating folks on how the deer harvest went. The muzzleloader season wrapped up last weekend. Natalie Ryder reporting that the muzzleloader kill was up, and that's adding to that increased tally for the overall deer kill this year, which is it continues to creep up.
Yeah, it does. That's good. And with decent weather till the end of the year, I bet you a lot of people get on archery hunt. I know if I had the opportunity, I probably would. I would too. Warm weather seems to get you back in the mood, or warmer weather, I should say. So maybe add to that. But we were up to 182,000 roughly earlier in the week. So good 10,000, 12,000 ahead of last year. I don't know what that percentage is. I suppose it's around 9%.
9% is what Natalie reported. Yeah.
It's a good bump up time to go, or hunting season to go yet with archery and more people tending to get out in December with the crossbow. We've seen that trend the last couple of years. So we'll add a few more. Muzzleloader was up 7%, I think she wrote.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So yeah, things are looking pretty good on the deer front.
As cold as it was last weekend, for muzzleloader to still be up, that's pretty impressive. So, yeah, I don't know if we'll hit 185, Tim. We might come close.
Yeah.
That would be, and last year was 170. So that's a nice increase. We keep falling back on the fact that we had two mild winters the past 2 years, and that probably helped. Yep. I guess it remains to be seen if we're going to get three in a row. I guess if this recent warming trend held up, maybe. But if we get too many more of those deep freezes, we might be talking winter severity index in January and February.
Well, it's looking like it. If it's anything like 3 years ago when we had a pretty colorful winter severity index map that the DNR puts out on a weekly basis. Yeah, I think we'll get there, but who knows? I swear it was 3 winters ago when there was a lot of snow and a lot of cold, and all of a sudden it was February or March, and there was a 2 or 3 day stretch of 70 degrees. Water was gushing everywhere. So right. You just never know. A big snow event can bring that snow total up. Especially the northern part of the state that sees a lot of snow in the first place, that'll start getting those points accumulating. And we did get some WSI points last weekend by being below zero in pretty much the entire state. So we've started, but who knows? It's the weather.
And Tim, deer kill in the Northeast was up double digits. That jumped out at me too. I think that was up 14% this mm-hmm. year. 14% of not much is not much, but nonetheless, it's still an increase and a sign that maybe deer populations are starting to bounce back up in Northeast Minnesota a bit.
Yeah, you would hope so. I'm guessing the two mild winters had the greatest effect there, where deer tend to struggle, especially with the harsh winters. Winters being more severe up there. The rest of the state, deer can find other food sources and cover. The Northeast is always brutal. So if there's a couple mild winters, that would be the place where they'd probably bounce back quickest, and that's probably showing up in the harvest.
Outdoor News Radio, Rob Jerusalem with Tim Spielman. We are kicking off this week's broadcast, final program before the Christmas holiday, so I hope everybody has a great break here this coming week. Tim, we should talk about your column a little bit. What the DNR is putting together, a report on wildlife management areas, and 2026 marks the 75th anniversary of our WMA system, so good timing there.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it was on purpose or not. Probably not, since it was 2 years ago when we started talking about a statewide, I guess they call it a system plan. But basically, and it's a little bit on the dry side, but as we always say with WMAs, it's the jewel, the gem of the public lands in Minnesota owned by the DNR. And when you're talking 1.4 million acres, it's a lot of places where hunters are tromping around in the fall. There hasn't been a real guiding type plan in place. There are plans for the larger ones. I mentioned Mille Lacs, WMA, Whitewater, Carlos Avery. There were, the DNR considers 8 of them to be large WMAs that have their own plans. But this is one for managers to use as guidance as they go about their everyday business on WMAs from the south to the north. And I first heard about it. Groups were pushing for it probably 2 years ago. And I thought that's when it officially was going to begin, at least the process, gathering information from conservation groups, local governments, et cetera, to put a plan in place. And it's kind of just, as I wrote, languished for about 2 years now. But it looks fairly formal now. The DNR has a series of meetings this month with conservation groups to just get a feeling for what they think WMA should be. And it should also be noted, and it's been brought up before in the context of other WMAs where other uses were discussed, that there is state statute that is fairly clear. No statute is completely clear, but it's fairly clear on what WMAs and aquatic management areas are to be used for. But a plan will not hurt, especially when it's an overarching plan, as well as getting down to certain parts of the state that are either grassland or deciduous forests or things like that. It's a good idea. And yeah, it won't be done until 2027. 2026 is the 75th birthday of the WMA system, which is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And you and I were both around at this newspaper for the 50th anniversary. I was trying to remember if we did anything, got WMA as a special present or anything. I don't think so. I don't recall. But anyway, that's coming up next year, and I think there will be a few events and things.
Yeah, it started with the Save the Wetlands program, and I'm sure we will highlight a lot of that 75th anniversary in Outdoor News next year. Like you said, 1.4 million acres. That's got to be one of the biggest state-owned landscapes in the country. And this is separate from state forests. These are mm-hmm. completely right. different from that. I'd be curious. I mean, there's obviously a lot of states with national forests and other federal properties, BLM properties. But I'd be curious how, you know, a state like Montana, how many acres do they have in state wildlife areas? I would be surprised if it's as much as we have here. So it really is an incredible asset. You know, I think in the early days, Tim, the conservation agency was probably driving the purchase of a lot of those acres. And my sense is probably in this past quarter century that you brought up, that maybe the nonprofits, you know, have been the driving force for, you know, finding these areas and purchasing them and then eventually moving them to the program.
Yep.
It's a public lands asset that I want to make sure the general public understands is really important and unique, and people mm-hmm. need to use it.
Yeah, and what's cool too is you might have parts of the state where you do have those state forests, federal forests or national forests, I should say, but the WMAs are scattered about, I think there's WMAs in every county. I'm almost certain of that.
Okay.
So even in places that don't have a lot of that other public land, you've got a WMA where you can go and hunt ducks or pheasants or turkeys or deer not too far away. If you're pretty much anywhere in the state, it's not too far out your back door that you have a spot if you don't have any other land.
Perfectly put, Tim. Thank you. You're going to join me next week. We will recap 2025, huh?
Yeah, it's already over. Unbelievable.
Well, yeah, definitely winding down. Well, Tim, thanks. And like I said, Merry Christmas to you and yours.
Yep, you as well. Thanks, Rob.
All right, we are going to grab a break. Sharon Stately, the bird chick, will be with us when we return. This is Outdoor News Radio.
The journey to deer camp only comes once a year, and we know you've got plenty of heavy, bulky gear to pack. Introducing the new Diverge case from Plano. Lightweight where it counts, tough when it matters. Ultra durable and lightweight thanks to a tough shell exterior with high density foam that delivers molded protection without the bulk. And a drop zone lid tray provides a convenient workstation for keys, cartridges, and coffee during pre-hunt prep. The new Diverge series cases from Plano. Don't just kinda be ready, be Plano ready.
By the numbers, here are the costs of not having Onyx fish. 400 extra holes drilled, 100 wasted ice miles, 20 needless gallons of truck, snowmobile, or ATV gas, 5 trips trying to catch a walleye where they don't live, 3 days of vacation you'll never get back, 2 wrong turns that cost you an extra hour at prime time, and 1 last time you'll waste dollars and effort. Onyx Fish, $34.99 per year, 10 Midwest states, countless ways to catch more fish.
Retirement can be scary, but only if you're not prepared. That's why AARP created thisispretirement.org. Because unless you've already retired, you're in pretirement and you still have time to plan. Learn about retirement savings options, potential tax breaks, and how you can build savings over time. Visit thisispretirement.org for free resources to help you customize your action plan and feel the retirement fear disappear. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Attention hunters, have you bagged an impressive whitetail buck this season? Then show it off at the Outdoor News Best Buck Contest, sponsored by Federal. The contest runs through January 2026. Bow, rifle, or muzzleloader, all hunters are welcome. Visit OutdoorNews.com for a shot at great prizes and bragging rights. Click the Best Buck Contest link atop the page at OutdoorNews.com to learn more, enter, and view official rules. That's OutdoorNews.com.
If you're hunting deer in Minnesota or surrounding states this season, be aware that deer carcass movement restrictions are in place in Minnesota. You cannot move whole intact carcasses out of CWD management zones or into Minnesota from other states, and only certain parts of your harvest can be transported. If you're heading to a licensed taxidermist from hunting out of state or in a CWD zone, there are regulations for you too. Visit mndnr.gov/deer imports to learn more. That's mndnr.gov/deer imports.
Smokey the Bear.
Then you know why Smokey tells you when he sees you passing through. Remember, please be careful, it's the least that you can do.
Don't play with matches, don't play with fire.
After 80 years of learning his wildfire prevention tips, Smokey Bear lives within us all. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com. And remember,
only you can prevent wildfires.
Brought to you by the USDA Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Howdy, folks. Welcome back. Outdoor News Radio. I am Rob Dreisline. Thanks so much for tuning in. You know the program here. If you like what we chat about, give us a call at 800-535-5191. You can subscribe to the print or digital version of Outdoor News that way, or you can do the same thing at OutdoorNews.com. We still got a few days before Christmas, so it makes a great holiday gift. A fine guest who's been with us before. It's been several months, but she's going to join us on either side of the Christmas holiday is my old friend Sharon Stitler, the bird chick. Sharon, welcome. It's good to see you and enjoying your social media posts. Look like you and your dog party are having a good time.
I love that dog so much. She was the best decision I made all year.
Just to remind folks, a party was a sled dog, a retired sled dog up in Alaska. You used to work up there, and you expressed interest in providing Party with a home in her retirement, and you won the lottery, huh?
I did, and she's hilarious. She does these crazy interpretive dances when she's hungry, which I sometimes put to music, and she's so smart. I have her trained when she's acting antsy to say, okay, tell me what you want, and if she walks me to the door, that means she needs to go outside. If she walks me to the kitchen, that means she's hungry.
What a great gal.
I know. Awesome. I know. She's so good. She's so good.
Well, Sharon, let's talk some bird topics here. We've got a lot of snow now. Everything is frozen up. Migration is over, right? Let's face it. But before migration was wrapped up, you wrote a little item for Outdoor News and OutdoorNews.com about a common eider that hanging around Lake Bemidji. You got to kind of be into ducks and be into birds to appreciate that, but that's a very rare specimen in this part of the world.
It is, and it's a sea duck, and they have really bizarre beaks. They have this kind of like huge schnoz of a beak that really, you know, you'll notice the profile. This bird looked like either a female or a young bird, and so it was brown and mottled. So to a casual observer, you might look at that and be like, that's a weird looking mallard, and why is its nose so big? But that was a cool bird to get for the state. And turns out that was not the only common eider that was here. There was a second one that a hunter shot, and I can't remember where, but it was in the state. Maybe it was Otter Tail County.
Yeah, so, Western Minnesota out there.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And that's legal. We should be clear about that.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Just, there's a 6-bird bag, and you have limits on some individual species within that bag, 2-hen mallard, 1 canvasback, things like that. But if an eider comes through, it's fair game. Mm-hmm. Like you say, a sea duck, you're typically going to see that, what, off the coast of Alaska?
Alaska. I've seen common eiders off the coast of Maine and Connecticut. So, yeah, it's a bicoastal. And, it's a sea duck, and it's cool to have. Have I seen all the eiders you can see in the United States? Because in Alaska, we had the common eider, the Steller's eider, the king eider, which is amazing, and the spectacled eider.
We've got another interesting bird you set out in the East Metro, Afton area, a goshawk. We see goshawks fairly commonly in northern Minnesota, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, that's where you typically find them. They're not super common. If you know how to look, you can find one. But in the metro area, they're not that common. A lot of people think they have them when they really have female Cooper's hawks because they're quite big. But no, this is for sure an immature northern goshawk that's been hanging out in Afton State Park.
And you mentioned the Cooper's hawk. So we've got 3 species of accipiters, right? We've got the sharp-shinned, the Cooper's hawk, and then the goshawk are our 3 accipiter species, right? What's the difference between them and some of the other hawks?
Okay, so fun fact, there's been a lot of change, and I just realized I've been saying northern goshawk. Number one, it's no longer northern goshawk. It's now American goshawk. It has changed. Hmm. And that is because there's been some taxonomy changes. So in the past, we always said we had 3 species of accipiter in Minnesota.
Right.
Now we only have 1, and that's the sharpshin.
Really?
The Cooper's hawk and the goshawk have now been put in a different genus, which is Aster, A-S-T-U-R, and it's throwing a lot of us off.
What are some other Aster species that I might be familiar with?
They're not really in the United States. There's one bird that looks like a Cooper's hawk, but it's called a Gundlach's hawk, and it's only found in Cuba. If you've gone down into Central and South America, you might have seen a bicolored hawk, which looks similar to a Cooper's hawk. But the little tiny sharpshin, it's still our little accipiter. But Cooper's and goshawk. Yeah, goshawk got a name change, and they both got a genus change.
Interesting. These taxonomists, they were renaming all these other species last year, right?
Oh, yeah.
Do they have too much time on their hands? Or do you think this is a good idea moving someone? And this happens all the time.
Oh,
I don't
yeah.
mean to suggest, but
yeah,
that's a pretty major change, I think, for those of us who grew up understanding, you know, that goshawk, sharpshin, and Coopers were kind of in their own little trio, their own little niche.
I see both sides of it. You know, like when I worked at Denali and they changed the name of Mew Gull to Short-billed Gull, that was frustrating because there was no other gull called Mew Gull. And even though the taxonomy changed, we still could have kept that. But as a park, we now have to look at all the signage that we have that says Mew Gull and change it, which takes time and money, and parks are already underfunded. I also know friends who work in collections, you know, and that means they have to reorganize all their specimens, and they don't have time for that nonsense. And by the time they get around to it, oh, hey, there's a change again. But I also understand that we're learning so much more about species and who is related to what, that we need to get that information out there. I think what just needs to happen is we just need to blow up the Linnae system and come up with a whole new one, I think.
Hmm. That would mean really revamping the collections.
I'm
still mad about the Clark's Nutcracker, but we don't have to go there. This is Outdoor News Radio. Rob Dreesline chatting with our friend Sharon Steitler. We mentioned that there's a goshawk, now an American goshawk,
yes,
out in the Afton area. We kind of talked a little bit about how taxonomy has reconfigured where that bird falls. But let's talk about, you know, the actual bird. They're pretty cool, right? They zip through the forest. I was thinking of just kind of little fighter jets careening through the trees, chasing grouse and species like that. They're kind of a forest hawk, right?
They are. They are my favorite hawk. And they're intense. I mean,
if
you've ever been unfortunate enough to come across an active goshawk nest, the male will fly around and yell at you. The female will try to cut you. I had a female fly right at my head. I had to duck because she was going to hit me. Then she whipped around and she went right for the kneecaps. I mean, it was intense. I mean, I've been around a lot of bird of prey. I've had a lot of peregrines dive at my head. I've had osprey try to drop sticks around me while banding them. The goshawk was terrifying, and I even knew what to expect. So yeah, I they also have a tendency to act before they think, and I find that very relatable.
And typically they're found in more northern forest regions. Do they nest in northern Minnesota, or are they more Canadian nesters?
No, we have goshawk that nest in the boreal forests of Minnesota. They're on the decline, but there are some up there. A friend of mine has done goshawk surveys up there, but you will find them in Canada. And we had them in Alaska. Sometimes at Denali, we would have to close the Rock Creek Trail because they would decide to nest on there, and it wasn't good for anyone.
I'd encourage anybody to Google a picture of a goshawk, a remarkable-looking bird. Before we go for this week, Sharon, the Eagle Cam is up and running, I guess.
Yeah.
We got a press release out on that several weeks ago. Season two, I think they said, of the new Eagle Cam.
Yeah.
I wonder if some people are a little surprised that an Eagle Cam would be up and running already. You know, it's been up running several weeks by early December. When people associate nesting with most birds being, you know, much, much later, a springtime activity. Why is the Eagle Cam relevant right now?
Well, those birds in particular have had a tendency to nest quite early. I mean, typically, you know, you associate bald eagle nesting more with March, but we have some overachievers here in Minnesota that will attempt to lay an egg in January. And if it's warm enough and they can find enough food, that egg can hatch and they'll raise that young. If we have a barrage of snowstorms or inattentive parents or not enough food, then they won't survive. But that's what birds do. Some birds do stuff super early and kind of gamble to see if they can get some more robust young out there, and some play it safe and nest a little later.
And most eagles, like you say, are going to start nesting in March. Some even nest later, right? If you get up into the lake region of Minnesota, mm-hmm. Wisconsin, they're not going to start nesting until there's open water, I presume.
There's that. Yeah. Well, and I mean, there's a lot of factors that are into it. You know, bald eagles, they eat out of our landfills quite a bit. I think that's also a factor in it, too. So if they have good access to food, and, you know, as we're looking at what's happening with avian influenza and it's not migration, maybe those chicks will stand a better chance if the parents lay the eggs early and can get them up and running before waterfowl migration kicks in. I don't know. It's tough to say.
But right now, it sounds like folks can see "quote unquote" courtship behavior.
Oh yeah,
and maybe see the eagles just kind of hanging around the area. But even these high achievers, like you call them, they will not lay an egg until January at the earliest. And with the winter we got going now, Sharon, who knows? Maybe they'll be a little more on the regular schedule.
Yeah, it's tough to say, but if the birds are active around the nest, have the camera going and let us watch. And if you want to go find bald eagles on your own, if you have access to a landfill, highly recommend it. Otherwise, look for areas of open water. I know here in the Twin Cities metro area, the Pig's Eye outflow over in St. Paul is a great spot to go. If you can get in on that Christmas bird count, that used to be my count spot. And yeah, we could see them quite clearly, but you can usually see them from the other side of the river. Red Wing is another great place to go over at Colville Park.
Wabasha. I mean, you've got the Chippewa River entering the Mississippi, so there's some open water. And that's one reason there's so many eagles hanging out there. You mentioned the Christmas bird count. We should mention real quick that, yeah, that's pretty well booked up. But if folks still want to monitor birds at their bird feeder, I believe they can still jump in. And Audubon.org for all the details.
Yeah, and they even have like a live feed now, so you can see photos that people are uploading pre-count and count day. So if you want to look at some pretty bird pictures, I would check out the live feed. Maybe you'll be surprised about what's being seen in your area.
Sharon, you'll join me again next week after the holiday and maybe talk owls with me?
Sure. Right, I'll be cool. Full of cheese, but yeah, I'll totally do that.
That's our friend Sharon Staitler. Follow her on social media, especially Instagram, The Bird Chick, Sharon Staitler. Thanks for joining me. Merry Christmas to you, Sharon.
Yeah. Christmas to you too, Rob.
Let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
You're out here to catch fish, not chase eggs and milk around the woods. Chef Robert's Gourmet Breading Mix is built for the outdoors. One step, no mess, no fuss. Just wet it, bread it, fry it, and get ready for the crunch that legends are made of. Grab a 12-ounce resealable bag and feed the whole crew. Fish, chicken, turkey, duck, and more. Find Chef Roberts at chefroberts.com, that's chefroberts.com, and never miss a bite.
The Journey to Deer Camp only comes once a year, and we know you've got plenty of heavy, bulky gear to pack. Introducing the new Diverge case from Plano. Lightweight where it counts, tough when it matters. Ultra durable and lightweight thanks to a tough shell exterior with high-density foam that delivers molded protection without the bulk. And a drop zone lid tray provides a convenient workstation for keys, cartridges, and coffee during pre-hunt prep. The new Diverge series cases from Plano. Don't just kinda be ready, be Plano ready.
Whatever you're hunting, be it small game, predators, gobblers, or big game, Henry Repeating Arms has a rifle or shotgun you can trust. With over 200 models to choose from, every Henry is proudly made in Wisconsin, backed by a lifetime warranty and supported by top customer service. From the squirrel woods to deer camp, there's a Henry for your hunt. Order your free Henry catalog today at henryusa.com. You'll also get a sheet of decals, the Henry Repeater newsletter, and a personalized list of local dealers. That's henryusa.com. Get your free catalog today and gear up for the season.
You fish the same waters year after year. But what if your next best fishing story is just a few miles away? Onyx Fish builds on 15 years of experience, giving hunters and adventurers a revolutionary angling tool to help you find new water, new access, and new fish. Find the right lake. Know the species, size, and abundance. Get expert local insight. Navigate to the right ramp fast. Then go fish in new lakes like they're your home waters. Don't chase reports. Make your own with Onyx Fish.
Is a trip to Alaska on your bucket list? It's time to dump that bucket and buy your ticket. And while you're there, fish the Kenai River with Jason's Guide Service. Jason is considered the best when it comes to catching Alaskan salmon, rainbow trout, and char. He's one of only a few guides that has the permit to fish in the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, where the salmon are easy targets and the trout and char are plentiful. So cross that Alaskan fishing trip off your list and check out jasonsguideservice.com. That's jasonsguideservice.com.
The Outdoor News Foundation is dedicated to nurturing the next generation of outdoor enthusiasts. Through your generous donations, we provide youth with access to OutdoorNews.com, educational scholarships, and grants. Every dollar donated goes directly to connecting young people with nature and outdoor activities. Help us cast a legacy for the next generation of outdoor enthusiasts and conservation leaders. Visit OutdoorNews.com to get involved, learn more, and donate today.
Hey everybody, welcome back. Outdoor News Radio, Rob Dreeslein with you for another segment. Hope you like the content here. Check us out online at OutdoorNews.com. If you do, or call us at 800-535-5191. Yes, Christmas is coming up this week, but still time to get in your holiday orders if you would like to subscribe to Outdoor News or OutdoorNews.com. Hey, something that is really full bore underway, it's already been underway for a couple weeks, is the ice fishing season. We've talked about it here a little bit on the broadcast, but I got a really great guest who's going to join me now and give me an update. He's been fishing all over the place. It's Tony Roach. He operates Roach's Guide Service, roachesguideservice.com. He's been with me before, but it's good to see you. And Tony, you got to be excited. What a great start to the ice fishing season, huh?
Yeah, to be able to go from literally boat in November, which, you know, right before Thanksgiving, I was out in South Dakota fishing in the boat, to fast forward, I shot some pheasants, and then boom, I was right on the ice. So as an outdoorsman, an angler, someone who loves to hunt and fish, it's amazing how quickly that transition happened this year. It's unbelievable.
That's great. How was South Dakota? I got to ask, you were on the Missouri River, you fishing walleyes?
I was, yeah. I've never been out to Mobridge in the fall. I've been hearing a lot about it. I've been seeing all these reports in the outdoor news, you know, these teeners that people are catching, and these giant mid-teen walleyes. We didn't get into the mid-teen walleyes, but we did get into a lot of walleyes out on the river. And what a beautiful place to fish. Just unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very different from most Minnesota fishing, and it's not that far away. So it's a cool experience to get out. I'm glad you got out there. But let's talk about what's happening right here in Minnesota, and that's ice fishing. We had a couple cold snaps here that really built a lot of ice. Despite having, you know, a fair amount of snow, we've been able to build ice despite that, would you say?
Yeah, you know, a lot of lakes are in great shape because when we got the bulk of the snow, I would say right after Thanksgiving, most lakes weren't capped over. And so that just created ice there. Then fast forward to right after the St. Paul Ice Show, we made a ton of ice during that cold snap. And then, of course, this last cold snap that we had made a ton of ice. You know, I've been on lakes like Mille Lacs and all over. It seemed like kind of that belt between, I would say, Fargo, shoot up to Walker, Minnesota, and then across to Duluth, and then swing back around through Aiken, Brainerd. That was kind of the bulk of the snow there. But because we had a little wind, a lot of the lakes had been on, like Mille Lacs, and even getting reports from my buddies out in Ottertail, there's not a ton of snow on the lake. And whenever you get these big cold snaps too, it sort of hardens that snow, and it seems like we're making ice kind of all over the place. And if you get further north than Walker or Lake Winnebogoche, they really didn't get the snow that we got, you know, a week and a half or 2 weeks ago.
So they got really good ice there.
They've got great ice. You know, it's all systems go up on Red Lake, up on Lake of the Woods. The fishing has been incredible in both locations, and I've been to both locations. It's been phenomenal.
Well, let's talk about some of the spots you've been. And you know, one thing we've got going this winter are some semi-liberal walleye limits, right? We got, what, a 3-fish bag on Mille Lacs. We had that late summer. The DNR decided to keep that in place for this winter. We're actually a little lower, right? It's a 4-fish walleye bag on Red Lake. I think it's down from 5. The DNR saying that the creel counts, the test nets are all real good, but it's just such a popular lake that they wanted to be a little careful with the amount of harvest. It sounds like the walleye bite's going great guns.
Yeah, it is. And Red Lake, it's on fire. Mille Lacs has been a really good bite. Mille Lacs is one of those lakes where we have a ton of bait fish right now. The lake is healthy. Right. It's kind of getting back to where it should be. But what's really cool about Mille Lacs is if you're a fan of fishing Mille Lacs, over the next few years, not only is the fishing going to be good, but the amount of fish in that lake is just going to continue to get better. Right now, there's a year class of fish in there that is like a record year class of 9 to 11 inchers. And when you go out to Mille Lacs right now, the bulk of what you're catching in a lot of areas are those 9 to 11 inch fish. Mm. And the crazy part about that is the last time we had a year class like this, it was another record year class. If you think back to that 2013 year class, so really kind of in that 2015 timeframe, 10 years ago, we experienced this exact same thing that we're seeing on Mille Lacs right now. So that bodes well for that fishery for years to come. On top of that, we have great perch numbers, great jumbo perch numbers, but then there's another year class of perch that are coming up that is in that record category as well. So there's a ton of perch that are in that 6 to 8 or 9 inch range right now. So next year is going to be phenomenal as well.
Of course, the perch limit on Mille Lacs, the DNR knocked that back to 10. The statewide, of course, is 20. At the end of last winter, they knocked it back to 5. So I guess you could say they've liberalized the limit from late last winter. What's the vibe among anglers on that? I would like to think that most anglers are more than happy to go home with 10 jumbos instead of 20.
Yeah, I think you sort of get mixed reviews on that, like any sort of limits. You know, people are going to have varying opinions. But most people last year were telling me, they're like, we don't need 20 perch. You know, we don't need 20 perch. I heard that a lot. I think a 10-fish limit is perfect. If you can go out there, you have a chance to harvest a few walleyes, and then you keep 10 perch, that's a lot of fish at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good day. Hey, what do you make of the DNR liberalizing the pike limit on Mille Lacs? They're telling people to keep some of those smaller pike up there. Any interest among anglers, you think, or are you seeing more pike when you're fishing up there?
I wouldn't say a giant uptick like you do. You know, you're definitely not catching pike like you would be if you're on Leech or Winnebogoche or Cass or whatever, or even some of the small lakes. But yes, I have seen a little bit of an uptick as far as the pike bite on open water, yeah, they went from a 3-fish limit to a 5-fish limit.
Okay.
They still have the protected slot of 30 to 40. So you got to throw those 30 to 40s back. And I really encourage anybody to throw those 30 plus inchers back, or 40 plus inchers back. Mille Lacs is such a special place for pike. I'm sort of torn on the limits. I mean, yes, we've seen a little bit of an increase in pike, but I wouldn't say it's widespread. I think maybe the DNR is just giving you a little bit more harvest opportunity when it comes to fish or fishing on the lake, just because it might be a little bit tougher as we get into late January, February for walleyes. I'm not sure the mindset there, but for me personally, I am loving the fact that I'm seeing pike recover on Mille Lacs. It seemed like for a few years, I wasn't seeing those big pike, especially in the fall, and now I am. Where it's going to be interesting, Rob, is when we get towards March, late February, March, early April, you know, pike regulations on Mille Lacs are open. So you can still continue to fish pike just like you would at Lake of the Woods. It's a real underutilized resource, but it doesn't close down at the end of February like everyone else. That stays open all the way through until opener. And so you can go out there and experience this really cool pike fishery. Now, I'm just begging anglers, if you're getting them over 40 inches, please put them back in the water. Yes. Obviously, 30 to 40 inchers have to go back. This fall, I did see quite a few fish that were in that 30 to 40 inch protected slot, which tells me that in the next few years, with the amount of bait in the lake, we're going to see really good big pike numbers.
Outdoor News Radio, Rob Dreisline chatting with Tony Roach, roachesguideservice.com. We spent a lot of time on Mille Lacs. We just got a couple minutes left here, Tony. What are some other hotspots that you're seeing here early in the season? You said you've been to Winnie. Red Lakes, you said it was going really well. I've talked to some other anglers up there. There's just a plethora of opportunities throughout North Central Minnesota, isn't there?
What's great about the age we live in as far as information age is everybody can get information on the hottest bite around. And I like hitting different destinations at different times of the year. I like going to Red Lake early. I like going to Lake of the Woods early, especially the South Shore, and then fishing Mille Lacs and just being able to do that. And I've been to all three locations this year. Let's start with Lake of the Woods. Lake of the Woods, that South Shore, was amazing and just on fire all summer and, of course, all fall. Well, that's carried over to winter. People that are going up and anglers that are going up to that South Shore Lake of the Woods are encountering really good numbers of all sorts of sizes of walleyes. You've got good year classes of sauger. You've got really good year classes of walleyes and jumbo perch. People are encountering some really good numbers of jumbo perch. When I was up there, the numbers were staggering as far as the amount of fish that we caught in an outing was very, very impressive.
Biggest perch I ever caught was on Lake of the Woods, and it was an absolute pig. There are some nice jumbos up there.
I think they have to get big to survive, Rob. You know, with the amount of mouths that are on that South Shore, it's either grow big or get eaten.
It's like the ocean. Yeah, everything's trying to eat you. Yeah.
Red Lake, I was up there, a few weeks back, that early ice. You know, Red Lake's always interesting because everybody, that's kind of their first destination because it freezes first, it's shallow, it's sort of in that boggy area. And what's interesting about Red Lake is almost always when I get out there, like first ice, when you're walking and the resorts are allowing traffic, it always seems the bites okay. And the reason being is that water's so dirty and churned up in the fall. It's always so windy on Red that it takes about a week for it to settle out. And a week after kind of that early ice frame or a week after that lake capped off, the bite went bonkers. And people were reporting 40, 50, 60 plus fish days. The cool part about Red as well is there's a ton of year classes. You're not just catching those cookie cutter eater size walleyes. You're getting a ton now that are in that 20, 21, 22, 23, which is great to see on Red. What's cool about Red Lake too is like, even though you're only allowed to fish a certain section of Upper Red Lake, there's so many resorts that, and there's so much area to kind of just get away from the crowds. And if you can get away from the crowds, you can have phenomenal fishing. You can bump into big schools of crappies up there, different year classes of walleyes. You can catch them all night long. It's a day and a night bite. Wheelhouses, it's a great destination for wheelhouses. So if you've got kids on holiday break and you want to pick a wheelhouse destination, it's awesome. You can get out there, get away from people, and just have an amazing time on the ice.
Tony, last quick question. If you could pick one technique to target early season walleyes, what would it be? What are you using?
Not possible, Rob. I do too much fishing. No, I'm kidding. It's hard because I love early ice pan fishing as much as I love early walleye fishing. But if I were to say just one in general, it'd have to be a spoon. You can grab a spoon of varying sizes and go out there and just catch fish, whether it's walleyes, pike, perch, panfish. A spoon tipped with, some Eurolarva, some plastics, either a minnow head.
Okay.
It's hard to beat a jigging spoon in the winter.
Yeah. Get a little meat on there, right? Yeah.
A little meat on there helps.
Yeah. Well, Tony, gosh, it's so fun to chat with you. I wish I had more time, but congratulations to you and all the other ice anglers out there enjoying, the past couple of years, right? The ice season really hadn't gotten going until the first of the year. You guys are getting some bonus fishing, and it sounds like a great bite. So enjoy this time, and Merry Christmas to you and yours.
Yeah, you as well, Rob.
That was our buddy Tony Roach, roachesguideservice.com. Let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages. By the numbers, here are the costs of not having Onyx fish. 400 extra holes drilled, 100 wasted ice miles, 20 needless gallons of truck, snowmobile, or ATV gas, 5 trips trying to catch a walleye where they don't live, 3 days of vacation you'll never get back, 2 wrong turns that cost you an extra hour at prime time, and one last time you'll waste dollars and effort. Onyx Fish, $34.99 per year, 10 Midwest states, countless ways to catch more fish.
You took the first step and quit smoking. But even former smokers may still be at risk for lung cancer. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know about a new low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early. It takes only 60 seconds and could save your life. You took the first step, now take the next. Visit SaveByTheScan.org for a simple quiz to see if you're eligible and talk to your doctor about screening. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
If you're hunting deer in Minnesota or surrounding states this season, be aware that deer carcass movement restrictions are in place in Minnesota. You cannot move whole intact carcasses out of CWD management zones or into Minnesota from other states, and only certain parts of your harvest can be transported. If you're heading to a licensed taxidermist from hunting out of state or in a CWD zone, there are regulations for you too. Visit mndnr.gov/deer imports to learn more. That's mndnr.gov/deer imports.
Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, a nationwide group working to keep public lands in public hands so future generations can enjoy what we enjoy. Join the group that makes a difference. Check us out at backcountryhunters.org.
Are you ready to hit the frozen waters and reel in some epic catches? The all-new OutdoorNews.com is your ultimate resource for all things ice fishing. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, OutdoorNews.com is the source for the latest tips, techniques, and gear reviews. Stay ahead of the rest with the most up-to-date ice conditions, fishing reports, and hotspots to maximize your success. Don't miss out on this incredible opportunity to elevate your hard water game. Visit OutdoorNews.com today and become part of the ice angling revolution.
Whatever you're hunting, be it small game, predators, gobblers, or big game, Henry Repeating Arms has a rifle or shotgun you can trust. With over 200 models to choose from, every Henry is proudly made in Wisconsin, backed by a lifetime warranty and supported by top customer service. From the squirrel woods to deer camp, there's a Henry for your hunt. Order your free Henry catalog today at henryusa.com. You'll also get a sheet of decals, the Henry Repeater newsletter, and a personalized list of local dealers. That's henryusa.com. Get your free catalog today and gear up for the season.
As farmers and ranchers, stewardship of the land comes naturally. You help keep water clean, improve the soil, and provide habitat for wildlife. But did you know conservation can also improve your bottom line? Learn more at conservationpays.org.
Everybody, welcome back. Outdoor News Radio, Rob Dreisline with you. Thanks for tuning in. Final segment of this week's broadcast. If you like what we talk about here, check us out online at outdoornews.com or call us at 800-535-5191. You can subscribe to our print or our digital versions that way, and there's still time to get your gift orders in. Outdoor News makes a great holiday gift. Tim Lesmeister here with us. Tim, very good to see you. Hope you and your family have a good week ahead with the Christmas holiday.
Should be a good week ahead. This is the time of the year when you get together with family, and both of us have big families. My wife had 5 sisters and 3 brothers. There were 9 kids in her family, 8 in mine, 6 brothers and 1 sister. Yeah, we have lots of family to visit and just enjoy, and it's just going to be always great fun whenever we get together with the people on the holidays.
Well, Tim, we've got a couple stories I definitely want to chat with you about. A couple non-resident related things. One, I wrote part of my column about Missouri turkeys, which is kind of an interesting topic. Minnesota is very closely linked to Missouri turkeys because most of the birds running around Minnesota have ancestors down in Missouri. Back in the 70s, the DNR traded some ruff grouse for wild turkeys with the state of Missouri, brought them up here into Houston County, where they kind of got a toehold going and a foothold, you might say. The population really blew up down there in Houston County. And then our DNR began its trap and transplant efforts, where they would, Gary Nelson and other guys down there in Whitewater would go and trap turkeys and take them to other parts of the state to get the population established. And now we got a fantastic turkey population in Minnesota. We kill about 16,000 birds. That's still only a third of what they kill in Missouri. A lot of hunters from Minnesota, Wisconsin, and other states, as I kind of mentioned in my column, go to Missouri to hunt turkeys. It was one of the few states where you could kill two birds. If you timed it right, you know, I think a couple seasons would kind of come up against each other and you could go down there and you could kill two birds. My dad did that for several years. I'm sure your buddy Mark Strand has done that many times. This guy, isn't his buddy Ray I down there or in Arkansas? But we've talked a little bit about some of the concern about turkey populations in the deep south, Mississippi, South Carolina. We're seeing turkey populations decline. We're not seeing that so much in Missouri, but nonetheless, some of the concern about non-resident pressure, I think, on some of the public hunting areas, the non-residents have barked at the Missouri Department of Conservation and declared, we don't want as much non-resident pressure. We don't want them taking two birds down here anymore. What do you make of that, Tim?
I think it's crazy. I think these people are so short-sighted. Do they not think of the people down there that are running businesses that cater to these hunters? The hotels, motels, gas stations, restaurants, convenience stores, all of these things that these hunters go down and spend massive amounts of money while they're in the state hunting. And they say, let's restrict these non-resident hunters. Let's not let these people from these other states come in and take our birds. It's mind-boggling to me that they think that that's going to help save the population of wild turkeys. All they really should do, instead of saying, let's keep the hunters from out of state as far away as we can, is say, let's produce habitat that's going to increase the bird populations and let's limit the amount of birds that can be taken. And you're right, two birds, maybe that's too many. So drop it down to one bird and make it across the board for resident, non-residents, and everybody else, and maintain your non-resident population of hunters, because if you start putting the kibosh to that, it's going to end up costing a lot of these businesses in a lot of ways.
In my column, I pointed out that non-residents represent 9% of the hunters, about 13% of the turkey harvest. So, you know, a little disproportionate amount, probably because a lot of non-residents are like, hey, I'm here, I want to take my two birds. So there's some of that going on, but those are still relatively small numbers, Tim, when you consider the volume of turkey hunting in Missouri. And back to your point, those non-residents are dropping a lot of money down there. It's symptomatic of what we're seeing nationwide. We usually associate it with the West, although your home state of Iowa loves to stick it to non-resident deer and turkey hunters too. But we also had another item about Montana really restricting the number of non-resident mule deer tags.
Which makes absolutely no sense at all, and here's why. Montana says they're having a decline in their mule deer population. Great. So they want to reduce non-resident licenses by 2,500 hunters? Are you guys out of your mind? And they also are going to reduce the number of deer a resident can kill from eight to three.
Wow.
I think that's probably where
this
discrepancy exists.
Yeah, you think?
This disparity is caused by the fact that resident deer hunters can kill eight deer. And because of that, you want to drop the number of non-resident hunters by 2,500? Please, this is Montana. You guys don't have a population large enough to take all of that money out of the state.
And like I say, this has irked me for years. We've seen it with waterfowl in the Dakotas. My real problem with some of that big game hunting restrictions out west is So much of the hunting, so much of the management occurs on federal lands, which our tax dollars are paying for. You know, whether you're from Minnesota, whether you're from Kentucky, I don't care where you're from, you're paying to manage all that land that, that contains those elk and mule deer. And yet these individual states just restrict the snot out of non-residents. It's very irksome. We had another story last week about some shenanigans in Idaho. Katie Hill covered that for us. I don't know. You and I have been ranting about this for decades. I guess it's just not going to change.
Maybe not, but it just makes no sense.
Thank God we got a lot of great hunting here, too. Maybe we should start charging non-residents more for it. Anyway, whole other issue. Outdoor News Radio, Rob Driesline and Tim Lesmeister winding things down. Tim, I real quick, I want to point out George Meyer next door in Wisconsin. He had been the DNR secretary over there, I believe, under Governor Doyle in the 90s after Tommy Thompson left. He passed away last week at the age of 78, had been battling cancer for a while. Great guy. After he left DNR, he was the head of, I believe, the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. So did a lot. Yeah, I mean, literally, the man worked in conservation for half a century. He was the head of the enforcement division at one point, was featured in Outdoor News many times. Just a tragic loss, and my condolences to his friends and family over there in the Badger State. And a conservation stalwart that we hate to lose too early.
Yeah, we're going to miss you, buddy. I'll tell you right now, the fact that Wisconsin has the resources it has in place has got a lot to do with this individual. He was a person that was conservation first, conservation always.
And then a final topic, Tim, also in my column, I wrote about this endorsement concept that the DNR intends to bring up with a report sometime in mid-January. Apparently, there's some other states, Colorado and Michigan, where you can purchase an endorsement, a parks access endorsement, when you get your vehicle tabs. And I think that's kind of a good idea. I think it, you know, it's a handy way to purchase it instead of having to go and buy it separately. And the DNR thinks, based on what they've seen in other states, that so many people will do it that they might be able to bring down the cost of these permits also. And there might be enough revenue that we could generate from it to eventually, you know, maybe help fund scientific and natural areas, maybe even some other public lands out there, surveys. The DNR has been doing this for the outdoors funding mechanism concept where they're brainstorming ideas for, I don't know, 4 years at least, and they haven't come up with much. This one actually looks kind of tangible to me.
Now, this is an optional thing, right?
Right.
So I don't have to buy this outdoor recreation endorsement. I can do it because I may want to go visit a state parks at some point, and just investing in this endorsement means I can just have that ability.
I really like this as a concept, and I don't know if DNR or anyone else would go for it, but if you're a bird watcher or a backpacker or some other public use kind of person and you want to visit one of our wildlife management areas that are completely funded by license dollars, you got to buy one of these endorsements. If you want to access these lands, you need to have a little skin in the game and buy one of these endorsements. I don't know if that's eventually where this could go, but I think it's got that kind of potential.
That's a great idea because you're right. There's a lot of people that are non-consumptive users of our properties, our lands, and they don't put a nickel into it.
They don't buy licenses. They don't pay excise taxes.
That's true. But, you know, I'm glad they're using it. I really want to see people outdoors. I really do. But if this is a way to, you know, get them to kick a few bucks out of their pocket and fund some of the beauty that we surround them with, and I think it's great.
I do not disagree with you, Tim. I'm always glad to see people out of doors, but managing these properties does cost money, and I'd love to see a way, again, to see non-consumptive people get a little skin in the game, and this might be a way. So more details on that when that report comes out in mid-January. Tim, thanks so much for joining me. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks. So Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. We'll catch up to you soon.
That was Tim Lesmeister. Thank you to him, all of our other guests. Everybody have a very Merry Christmas. Rob Driesline signing off for Outdoor News Radio. Missed a segment from this week's edition of Outdoor News Radio? You can hear a podcast of the complete program at OutdoorNews.com or via your favorite podcast streaming platforms. And for the rest of the story on the topics we cover here on the program, get yourself or a friend a subscription to Outdoor News. Just visit OutdoorNews.com. And don't forget to join us next week on this station to talk everything out of doors.